This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about civil liberties in the Bush age, and with me to discuss this is Kit Gage, the director of the First Amendment Foundation and also director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. Kit Gage is the editor, and I'm soft on editors, of a new book called The First Amendment Felon. First Amendment Felon, the story of Frank Wilkinson, his 132,000-page, if you can believe it, FBI file, and his epic fight for civil rights and liberties, a book whose author is Robert Sherrill. Kit Gage, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's my pleasure.
How long have you been doing this kind of work for civil liberties, for the First Amendment?
It seems like almost forever, but for NCARL since about 1986. So that's almost forever.
And how did you fall into it?
Well, I fell into doing progressive work. I'm one of those boomer people who opposed the Vietnam War and was involved in women's rights work and early on got involved with the National Lawyers Guild, whose role is really to do legal defense for progressive movements. And that got me a start in understanding how important it is to defend people's movements.
Are you still involved with the Lawyers Guild?
Yeah, I am.
And the Lawyers Guild has done a lot over the last few years representing people. I know. I remember back in Miami at the FTAA protests where there was police brutality and crazy infringements on civil liberties. The Lawyers Guild was there and present. Tell me a little bit about Frank Wilkinson, who is the subject of this Robert Sherrill book, First Amendment Felon, and was your predecessor at the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. I just met him once. I think it was about, it's got to be more than 10 years now, probably more like 15 years. He came by the Progressive's office, and we had a discussion with our editor at the time, Irwin Nolan, was very friendly. But I didn't ever get to hear him talk or see him in action. What was he like?
Frank was an amazing character. He fell into doing civil liberties work after about a decade or so doing public housing work in Los Angeles, and he was targeted at the time, sort of the early McCarthy era, and asked what groups he belonged to, and he at that point took the Fifth Amendment, was promptly fired, headlines screaming across the LA Times. And he was that was it. That was it for him. That was it for a fabulous public housing project he was involved with. And it turned him into a fighter for civil liberties ever after, really. So a lot of people who had that experience reacted differently than Frank did. Frank seemed to take energy from the attacks on him. And he was not only a sort of a hero in that he stood up to the House Un-American Activities Committee, but he also helped people organize who had themselves been targeted. And most people, you know, it was enough sort of if you stood up by yourself to that kind of attack. But he just said, no, I'm going to help other people. I'm going to go around the country. And he did. He went around the country for 40, 50 years organizing people, explaining how important it is to stand up for your rights, to stand up for your dissent activity.
Robert Sherrill calls him a First Amendment evangelist.
Yeah.
I kind of like that phrase. But he must have given thousands, maybe tens of thousands, 10,000 speeches on civil liberties.
Easily.
Oh, it's incredible. He is famous. He was famous for standing up for taking the First Amendment and not the Fifth Amendment before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Why did he decide to do that, and what's the significance of that?
He was – lots of people took the Fifth Amendment. People kind of understand that's the where you say, I have the right not to speak. But that was widely viewed as a cop-out and an acceptance that you were, in fact, whatever it was the government said you were. Frank and the local groups he was working with initially were looking for somebody who would make a test case. There were a number of people who took the First Amendment who said the government has no right to say what groups I'm a member of, or to ask what groups I'm a member of, and they often went to jail. Sometimes they didn't. Frank said, I want to take a case to the Supreme Court. So he and Carl Braden were the last people to take the First Amendment, to try to bring a First Amendment challenge. And Wilkinson v. U.S. was a Supreme Court case went up to the Supreme Court and failed by one vote.
He lost to the Supreme Court.
He lost the Supreme Court by one vote in a really amazing the arguments are amazing on both sides, especially on the losing side. And he and Carl were the last people who went to jail. I spent 9 months in the different federal pens in 1961, the last people to go to jail, because it was really – it was a nationally known case. And it helped to put the kibosh on the use of asking that question.
Hugo Black, the Supreme Court justice who wrote a minority decision in that case, was really out front and furious at his other justices who didn't see how repressive this kind of attack on Wilkinson was. And Hugo Black said, at least according to the book here, that every single member of the Supreme Court had been accused of the same kinds of things that Frank Wilkinson had been accused of, and had they been dragged before a Senate committee and refused on the grounds of the First Amendment to testify, why, they could have been convicted too.
Absolutely. And that was Frank's point.
1961, a lot of people don't understand that McCarthyism predated McCarthy and postdated McCarthy, that this Red Scare was going on long before McCarthy was pulling pieces of paper out of his vestments and saying he has a little list here, and long after he was disgraced. Why do you think people have that misunderstanding? And by the way, what was your view of good night and good luck?
Well, Frank had the same view. He objected when people called it the McCarthy era, and I think I misspoke earlier. He would be mad at me. He called it the Hoover McCarthy era, and I think that's much more appropriate, because J. Edgar Hoover, from the very get-go, from the beginning of the creation of the FBI, the FBI was created after the Palmer raids in 1919-1920, the FBI went after immigrants who were not involved in the Palmer raids and tried to disgrace them and deport them.
And Hoover was involved even back then.
That was the beginning of the FBI, and Hoover was right there, center stage, creating and directing that activity. So it really was the FBI's prime activity from the 1920s on through the middle 70s, give or take, after COINTELPRO was disgraced. I saw Good Night and Good Luck, and in its film noirish self, I think it was good for what it did. It was nice and focused.
My feeling was it was too focused, though. You didn't get the sense that 50,000 people lost their jobs or that 400 people went to prison.
Absolutely. It was a tiny little story, and it didn't tell what went on before, and it didn't tell what went on after, and it did imply that, you know, one man's effort in, you know, did McCarthy in, when it was more like Frank Wilkinson and 50,000 people around the country. As with everything, it's, you know, it's like the Rosa Parksization of everything. It's as if, you know, people act like Rosa Parks acted alone when she was part of a movement.
It's the great man theory of history.
Precisely. And it's almost never true.
Absolutely. And the other thing about the film, you know, I enjoyed the film, but I just wish it had done so much more. In just providing a little historical context, I think it was difficult for the viewer to understand why one minute Joe McCarthy is grilling a witness and the next minute Joe McCarthy is being grilled by the Senate. Right. It didn't really give a sense as to why that happened, except, you know, Edward R. Murrow was God, which is not a great lesson for people who don't believe themselves to be that powerful and aren't, you know, at CBS News and the most popular and powerful journalist of the day. And as you point out, a lot of people played their part, including Frank Wilkinson, who was the director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, which you now direct. He also was a member at some point of the Communist Party.
He was.
Why did he join? When did he leave?
I think he joined. I never really got to discuss it with him. I'm, by the way, let me step back and say I'm really happy. Frank didn't ever talk about being a communist in his life, and I'm really delighted that the fact that he was a communist is in this book, because it to some extent demystifies it. And Frank, I think, joined like lots of other people did in the United States. He joined because he saw all these great people doing important work, and especially in the public housing arena where he was in L.A., and most of them, or a chunk of them anyway, were in the Communist Party. And he said, gosh, if people doing this work are in the Communist Party, I ought to too. And so he joined, and his wife joined, and he stayed. It's kind of funny almost. He stayed in the Communist Party. I don't know that he was never in leadership. He was never, I don't think, a particularly active member. But he stayed in the party until the middle 1970s, when I think about almost the only people left in the party at that point were FBI informants and Frank. And he quit the party for a First Amendment reason, because the party objected to the Ku Klux Klan marching in Chicago. And he, being a straight-out First Amendment stalwart, said, I will not stay in this party that violates the First Amendment. So I think it's a stitch.
And now Frank Wilkinson passed away earlier this year.
Yeah, in January.
And what was the cause of his death?
His body gave out.
How old
was
he?
He was 91, and the last few years, he pretty much had stopped traveling and speaking very much. But even long before that, I was sort of amazed that he was able to keep going, just because his back and his legs and everything was kind of giving him, it was having the aches and the pains. But he was so committed to doing this work, and I think it's just, he was one of those wind-up people. You really can't stop him until he winds down.
My former boss, Irwin Knoll, is exactly the same way. I'm speaking with Kit Gage, who succeeded Frank Wilkinson at the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. Kit Gage is also the director of the First Amendment Foundation, and she served as the midwife, according to her, of this book about Frank Wilkinson, which is called First Amendment Felon by Robert Sherrill, and I recommend that to our listeners. It's a book published by Nation Books. In the last section of this half hour, Kit, I'd like to get your reading of the Bush administration and how different its assaults are on civil liberties than its predecessors, or how similar they are. This is a problem I've had in assessing the Bush administration, not only on civil liberties issues, but on foreign policy issues. To what extent is it a departure from U.S. interventionism since, you know, the Mexican War, or certainly since after World War II? And to what extent, for you, are what we're seeing as far as civil liberties infringements similar to or different from what has come before?
I asked Frank that question a year or two ago, and I was very interested to hear him say that he thought that post 9/11, of course, he like everyone thought that the terrorist attacks were horrible and required the government to take very particular important steps to try to deal with terrorist attacks. But he thought that the activity of the Bush administration post 9/11, by and large, was wrongheaded and was creating civil liberties problems worse than what he experienced in the Cold War and the Red Scare. And I'm, you know, it's a little like comparing apples and oranges, because you can clearly point out that, as we discussed earlier, there more people lost their jobs, for example, through the House Un-American Activities Committee and the effort to blacklist people for their political activity. Many more people lost their jobs and careers were destroyed than in the recent times. But there are a lot of similarities in that, especially non-citizens, I think, have been particular targets in the past, but I think even more really in the present day. And many of the rights that we long fought for, that we got really in the 1970s in particular, the right not to be surveilled without really important evidence of criminal activity, the right not to have your house broken into by the government, those kinds of things, especially when you add the layer of new technology, I think have gone, may well have gone beyond what we saw in the early days. And in some ways, it's more, to me at least, it's worse in some ways because we have history in front of us. We have the misdeeds of the FBI in front of us, and nonetheless, the government is repeating those mistakes.
And getting away with it, too. I mean, you did have some fighting back at the end of 2005 in the Senate, led by Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, who was holding up the renewal of the Patriot Act. Also at the grassroots with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee out of Northampton, Massachusetts, Nancy Talabian, who wrote the foreword with you of this great book by David Cole and James Dempsey, Terrorism and the Constitution. She's been, and her group's been responsible for 400 cities and towns and counties around the country opposing the Patriot Act in its unconstitutional aspects. And so that led a grassroots movement that lit a fire under some of those senators and got them to pay attention to these civil rights infringements, civil liberties infringements, which was a movement not just of the left, but a left-right kind of organizing effort, which was very impressive. And yet the Patriot Act got renewed with only, to my mind, cosmetic improvements. What was the difference? What were some of those improvements? And do you share my sense that they're cosmetic more than anything else?
Well, I think, let me just back up a little bit, because I think that anytime you have a terrorist attack like 9/11, but the Oklahoma City bombing is another example, you're going to have the government's going to respond with some likely, I mean, history tells us, with some wrongheaded responses which give the executive branch greater authority. And the USA Patriot Act, those of us, especially in Washington, who have followed these things forever, knew in 3 seconds that was going to be coming. We didn't know how bad it was going to be, but we knew it was coming, and we started organizing around it. But there was no way that we could do anything very effective to stop the USA Patriot Act.
Were you in D.C. on 9/11?
Yeah, I was.
What was that like?
Well, my older daughter was in college, probably in the flight path of the plane that landed on the Pentagon, and it scared the bejesus out of me. But I knew it scared, you know, I mean, I wasn't even in New York, but it was directly frightening to me, you know, in terms of my family and you know, other people I know that died in the Pentagon and other places like many of us. And, you know, it doesn't take away from that, from the horror of those acts, to say the government needs to go after terrorists in the right way. So much of what happened in the Patriot Act and changing the domestic attorney general guidelines, rounding up people by ethnicity and by religion, are completely wrongheaded and completely not only are wrongheaded, but really go against effective fighting of terrorism. You know, it was so angered me to see the way the Arab American and Muslim community in the United States, with whom I have pretty close ties from work on secret evidence I had been doing before 9/11, to see how alienated they got from the U.S. government, because I said these communities need to be allied with the government, need to be listened to by the government to help it distinguish between people who would do criminal things to U.S. people or others, and people who are engaged in dissent activities or who are merely living their lives. And by alienating so many people in this country, you know, particularly those communities, but other communities as well, I think it worsened the situation in terms of fighting terrorism.
I think there has been a real differential effect of the repression, that it hit so much more with so much more force on Arab and Muslim communities here in the United States than it did on U.S. citizens who weren't Arab or Muslim, that the perception of the repression is so different. For those of us who weren't in those communities, I think it's hard for us to imagine what that fear was like, of the fear of just being a suspect by virtue of who you were. And that kind of blanket suspicion really goes back to the Japanese-American internment camps.
Absolutely. But since 9/11, I think that I've seen so much improvement, gradual improvement in organizing, gradual improvement in the way that people understand that they need to take back their government and get it back on the right direction. So where I agree with you in general in terms of your question a bit ago, that the amendments to the USA Patriot Act are, are a mixed blessing and probably not very much. I'm not even sure if they're better. Some of the improvements are better than some of the things that aren't so good. But I think the main point of that is it took a lot more effort for the government to get those amendments through. There were Republican senators who stood up and said, this is not, you know, to the original way that those amendments were going through, this is not my country if we have these kinds of amendments. That I see as hopeful. You can't organize quickly out of this kind of really massive explosion in executive branch authority. It takes a long time. It's a decade-long process at best. That's if we win. It's a decade-long process to get things back on some even keel where there is some measure of a balance of power.
And if we lose?
Then it's a 20-year effort.
I'm speaking with Kit Gage, the director of the First Amendment Foundation and the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You're talking about this organizing effort in defense of civil liberties. You've mentioned to me the importance of organizing across boundaries. What do you mean by that?
One way I mean that is we have a Republican-led Senate and House and executive branch and increasingly judiciary. And the only way that you can successfully influence them in terms of in any terms, whether it's lobbying or just getting news out there, is working with people on the right, the left and the right, working together to stabilize the balance of powers.
Now, how do you tell people on the left, on the progressive side, to do that when some of the people on the right that they may be finding an alliance with or potentially could find an alliance with are anathema on so many social issues like abortion or gay rights, for instance? How do you tell progressives that you're not selling out when you get in bed with these people?
You don't sleep with him. You just get in bed with him. Grover Norquist and I.
You know Grover Norquist.
I know Grover Norquist and I have worked together on civil liberties issues. We don't agree on a million things, but we agree on the core civil liberties of this country. And when you agree to disagree, you just say, you know, we're just working on this one core thing, and you know, we're not going to have to I don't sign on to all the stuff that Grover supports, and Grover doesn't sign on to all the things that I support. But on the core issue of the right to dissent and the core issues of the First Amendment and due process, we're together, and that convinces a lot more people about the validity of those issues than 100 people with whom I share many more issues in common agreeing on those issues.
Grover Norquist is the conservative organizer who is famous for the line that he wanted to drown the federal government in a bathtub.
Right.
What is he like?
He can be, as you might imagine, he can be a very gregarious man. But he is really irritating as well. But on the other hand, I you got to give him credit. He is not anti-immigrant, and I really truly appreciate that issue. And I think every once in a while there are people who you just decide there's too many things I disagree with them to work on. But there are really a remarkable number of folks on the right, not just Grover, but many people who are particularly sort of more of a libertarian bent. Who agree with many, many of these core constitutional issues and who are very stalwart in working with the coalitions. The Liberty Coalition is one that I've worked with a fair amount recently, but there are others. And I think the only way to be effective in the Congress and the only way to be effective a little bit in some where you can with the executive branch, short of new elections, is by working with those coalitions.
Kit Cage, I believe that Grover Norquist also opposed Bush's NSA spying, though I can't say for absolute certain on that. What is your assessment of the NSA spying scandal? Russ Feingold calls for censure. Others of us are calling for impeachment. Is it worthy of impeachment, or is impeachment a fairy tale, as the New York Times calls it?
I've sort of gone back and forth on that issue, on what should be the sanctions, but I don't think it's sanction time. I think what's really important right now, well, there's two things that are important. One of them is it's a lesson in how important it was for us to have organized in the past, because without organizing in the past, we would not have had the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it is because of the presence of that law that it's so clear that the Bush administration has violated the law. If there hadn't been a law that says if you're going to engage in this kind of surveillance, you have to go through X, Y, and Z process. It's very explicitly set out in FISA. It's very explicit that the administration violated it. So you can go after the administration for violating this law. And indeed, the Congress should proceed with investigations, and we should push for the full elaboration, understanding what exactly was done. Call for an investigation, find out what was done, and then proceed judicially with what's called for then.
And I'm quite certain that we haven't seen the full dimension of this spying scandal yet. Either all the infringements that the NSA itself is committing and also other agencies of the federal government and state and local police as well. Really, the size of the repression is kind of staggering when you look at it all across the board. And I think the reigning assumption that I have is that every agency, law enforcement agency in the country, from campus police all the way to the CIA and the NSA and the FBI and now Rumsfeld's Department of Defense, is getting in on the act. We only have about a minute left. What can people do to fight back?
There are lots of groups on the left and the right who are fighting the whole array of different abuses that you're talking about. Whether if it's locally, I urge that people work to defend their local right to dissent. I'm working to promote a D.C. law that was recently passed to help local police understand the importance of the right to dissent and to get new law in place, which has largely been abandoned in recent years. And I think that's a great local place to start. Nationally, if you go to the websites, the firstamend.org and ncarl, ncarl.org, on those websites you can find about 100 different groups, many working on the NSA surveillance issues and really the whole array of civil liberties abuses. There are lots of us working together. You can get at us from different, whatever your particular individual interest is. ACLU, National Lawyers Guild, Campaign for American Progress, Center for Democracy and Technology. Take your choice.
Kit Cage, so much of a pleasure to have you in the studio with me, to meet with you and to discuss these issues. Thanks for being my guest.
I'm so delighted to be here.
And those organizations, again, are firstamend.org and ncarl, ncarl.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.